Well, I think we always knew that a biography of Michael Kirby was going to be, or should be, a good book and a good read, and bring lots of really important issues to life. So it's basically always gratifying when you know that any readers have reached that view of the book. And in this case, obviously, the judges of the award think it's at least good enough to get through to the shortlist stage.
Because a critical acclaim is obviously very different to a book being well received by the public. Has it been a case of both of those in your case?
It certainly has. I mean, if you want to write a book about important and weighty issues like the role of the judiciary in society and the politics of our judges and their relationship with government and issues of the day, then there's always going to be a sort of a bit of density to that, especially if you're writing it as a lawyer and a political scientist trying to bring those things to life. But I think it's had both because, I mean, I've had emails from people who have said that, readers in Sydney who have said it made them miss their train stops reading the book. So you know when a book grabs people's attention that much, that it makes for a good read as well as being something that's got some critical depth.
When you look at the subject matter and law generally, some people can find that quite impenetrable, I suppose, particularly the language. How did you make this appeal to a wide audience?
Well, Michael Kirby as an individual is someone who has specialised his whole career in making political issues and legal issues accessible to a wider audience. So, in many ways, using his fascinating life and career and his impacts on the law and on politics, the vehicle for telling the story further brings them to life for all sorts of reasons. From more recently, he's really been defined by his sexuality and the fact that he was the first openly gay High Court judge. But way before that, he was engaged in opening up questions about, well, how should the law adapt to keep with the times? How should technology, how should science, how should all sorts of changing social values be incorporated in both what judges do, but also in what our parliaments do to keep the law up to date and keep it in line with what society wants. So there's a whole range of really sort of important issues to do with privacy and technology and the computer age and how our institutions are or aren't adapting to meet those sorts of changes, which are woven right throughout the whole book, and it really tells the story of the last 40, 50, 60 years of change in Australian society.
And how much of a role did Michael Kirby play in that change?
Well, a very large role because he was the foundation chairman of the Australian Law Reform Commission in the 1970s, a new body specifically looking at how Commonwealth law, how federal law should be updated to cope with change. And really, that's when he became famous. But then as a judge in the 1980s and 1990s and through to 2009 when he retired from the High Court, he was constantly at the edge of questions of, well, the judiciary itself should be prepared to say, look, no, we need to change the principles. We can't be bound by old cases from the 1800s in England in our thinking about how to handle this. And so was quite controversial in that sense in opening up questions of how the law should adapt, and also how the law should be internationalised. He was very much, and is very much still actively, a very global figure. Again, quite controversially, saying our law needs to be consistent and compatible with international principles. And so on a whole range of issues like human rights or Indigenous recognition in the Constitution or all sort of manner of issues about how social values should be reflected in law. He's been very, very active and had a very big impact.
You were given rare access, I suppose, to his, I imagine, vast catalogue of documents and judgments and rulings. What do you see as being the highlights of his career?
Well, some of the highlights, I guess, that I'd see and convey in the book. Some of the things that are a bit buried, I guess, because he has been so high profile, and you can listen to his speeches and you can see him speak and you can read his judgments. But what was really good about getting access to his correspondence and his papers, including things that he'd obviously completely forgotten about and to some extent buried, were getting access to the to the mistakes that he made along the way that nobody knows about, that explain how he's survived as a public figure. I mean, as a judge, he's no longer a judge now, so this is past tense, but he was especially controversial for speaking out publicly on different social and political issues when most judges would regard that as being just incompatible with the judicial role, that you just sit in court and stay in court and you don't air your views outside court. And he had to learn how to manage that public profile through a bit of trial and error. So there's a few mistakes where he made, the odd speech in Washington on issues to do with cases that where judgments hadn't yet been handed down in Australia, which nobody knew about, nobody would know about till I've opened them up through papers in this book. And I mean, that's just part of the explanation of sort of presenting a full picture of how it is that he came to be such a high profile figure and manage that profile in a way that did try and respect the judicial role, but there were a few accidents along the way that help explain how he's managed to do that.
When you say he had a few accidents, did you come across any evidence that he was ever remorseful or regretted saying particular things?
Yes, I think like anybody, at the end of the day, when confronted with either at the time or on reflection with sort of incontrovertible evidence that he'd made a mistake, he accepted that. So the particular case that I was just referring to of a speech that was sort of out of line in terms of its of having compromised some of the judicial process was something that he does now accept and did later come to accept as having been sort of overstepping the line, if you like. But I think the other part of the story that really comes through is the amazing tenacity and discipline and persistence of some people, especially an individual like Michael Kirby, seeking to have the type of impact that he's had on the law. People have told me that they've found it to be an education in just what sort of an ego some people need to have in order to have the type of impact that they do at really high levels of judicial or political life. And that in itself is an interesting reflection, I think, on the demands that we put on very senior judicial and political figures to be infallible and to be, to work 10 times as hard as anybody else has to in order to maintain the types of very important roles that they have.
Where was the resistance or opposition to some of the reforms he was pushing for in the legal system coming from? Did you find any correspondence from particular groups or individuals who may have applied that pressure?
I think the overall pattern of Michael Kirby's career really points to sort of the inherent conservatism of the legal profession itself most of the time. That the nature of, and this is something that I think sort of all legal academics and judges are relatively explicit about, that the job of the law and of the courts is not to sort of boldly reshape principles that that perhaps parliaments should be determining if we need to change the law, that it should be up to parliaments to do it, elected parliaments. That's the democratic way to keep the law moving. But in some ways, the book really does tell the story of the fight that's constantly going on with the fact that we do live in a society where, if we're honest with ourselves, I think we know that we can't expect parliaments to do the full job of keeping developments in the law up to date and of reconciling our social values with how we want to see the law work on a day-to-day basis in our society, whether it's in sentencing or whether it's in recognising how the duties of one citizen against another should be defined and when they should be honoured. The whole book is about many, many things, but it's partly about that tension between what's the role of the judge in taking on that that mission of saying, you know, my job is to make sure that justice is done, versus my job in ensuring that the rule of law is enforced, whether I like it or not, or whether the content of the law is actually inadequate. And so that really goes to the heart of sort of the tensions between conservatism and caution, and wanting to see justice and wanting to see values respected and developed, that goes on within all of us, I think.
The book obviously asks a lot of questions. Do you provide any answers to those questions?
I took the approach that the most important thing in a biography is to let the reader decide what they think of this person and these issues. So I've obviously been, in writing the book, you have to leave an enormous amount of material out, and you can't possibly include absolutely everything, and people would then drown in the massive detail of someone's life. So what I've done in framing the story of his life is just tried to make sure that those big issues are all there, and that both sides of the issues are there at any particular time, so that people can decide for themselves. Many people think Michael Kirby is an absolute hero. Many other people think that he's quite controversial and at various times a bit of a dangerous influence on our institutions, or have done. And
how do you see him now?
I've always seen him as somewhere in between those things. Not nearly as radical as many people who think he's radical think he is. He's actually a very, very conservative person and figure in the way that he understands and values most of our key institutions. But at the same time, he's somebody who, as I describe in the book, is someone who didn't have to be radical in order to have radical effect on society. So at the same time as I think he's actually quite conservative in his own values, and this is one of the paradoxes of him, he has really challenged all of us to think about our own values, not just as a result of his sexuality, but much broader political values about what sort of society we want to be. He's a true sort of old-fashioned, small-L liberal who doesn't sit and never did sit comfortably in the age of sort of politics where we're caught between sort of the two major sets of parties, sort of conservative coalition and sort of institutionalised Labor parties. And so he, in many ways, he captures values that are sort of very central to society, but which don't get major reflection in the way in which our politics unfolds. So I think for that reason, and to do with his personal qualities, he's confronted all of us and confronted Australian society with sort of very hard questions along the way about what sort of society it wants to be. And that's had some very significant and radical impacts, even though he's quite a conservative individual in many respects himself.
And just finally, what does Michael Kirby think of the book? Has he read it?
He has read it. He had access to drafts so that I could get him to correct factual errors and make sure that that nothing took him by surprise in terms of sort of criticism or analysis that he might be uncomfortable with. And I think that there has been some criticism and analysis in the book that he found very challenging.
Such as?
Well, I think just being called to account for some of those sort of mistakes along the way, and as somebody who, although he's not someone I would regard as radical, he has enjoyed and used his reputation as someone who's quite progressive to maximum effect in the course of his own career. So I think having that sort of questioned in critical ways was something that I don't know that he was anticipating that a biographer would come along and do that, at least within his lifetime. And so that was part of the challenge of writing the book, was to actually take advantage of his cooperation but still tell it like it was, for the benefit of everybody's understanding. And so I think that he found the outcome of the book to be quite a challenge, But then, as anybody who reads the book will know, he's not a shrinking violet when it comes to attention. So at the end of the day, he recognises that it's a book about him. And now
the book's on his website being advertised, so he must have taken it in his stride to a large degree.
Well, he's still in a position where he can exercise his own right of reply in relation to, and he has been exercising his own right of reply subtly around the place in relation to the things in the book that he might not agree with fully.
He hasn't gone after the people who you've cited as criticising him, has he?
I don't think I cited anybody as criticising him who he wasn't already aware of as a critic. I think it accurately describes the sort of the career landscape within which he knows he's sat. And what's more important than that is that it opens up that whole professional landscape and those sort of inner questions about how our institutions work. It's opened those up to people who might not have known, you know, might not really know how the judiciary works or how the relationship between the judiciary and the government works or doesn't work. From that point of view, I think he accepts it, and I think a lot of people have found it a good book as a result, that even if it was inaccurate, you know, 5% of the time, and I'm not saying it is, I'm saying it's 100% accurate, but the broad purpose of the book in bringing to life those sorts of questions about our institutions, it seems to have worked.